You are listening to the Experience 50 podcast. I'm your host, Mary Rogers. This show is about being middle-aged. You'll hear my conversations with ordinary and not-so-ordinary midlifers about their quest to pivot, their perspectives on our world, and the common experience of living in a time when 50 isn't old yet. Sometimes it's going to be funny. Sometimes it's not. But you will want to listen. Hi, guys. It's Mary Rogers. Thanks so much for tuning into the Experience 50 podcast. Today's episode is sponsored by Monthly Clubs. If you're looking for a last-minute gift, this is just about the easiest thing that you can do. If you go to experience50.com/monthly, you can put together a custom package or the club of the month for cigars, wine, cheese, flowers, chocolates, whatever your friend you think would enjoy. So check it out. Again, that's experience50.com/monthly. And in minutes, you can create a very special personalized gift and then immediately print the certificate or email the announcement of your gift. How cool is that? Okay, today we have a special guest with us. We have Therese Murray. And we're just going to go ahead and I'll share the interview with you right now. So we're jumping on the phone right now with Therese Murray, who I haven't seen her since 2008 when she and I were both hard-driven career women, which I guess we still are, but we were doing different things at the time. And Therese came to my town to speak to a women's group that I was leading, and she's just got terrific insights about leadership skills and how to be an effective executive. And we touched base maybe 3 or 4 months ago. I got a note from Therese saying that she had made some significant pivots in her life. And she saw that that's what my new career was all about, was podcasting and blogging about midlife. And so it took me a while to bring the connection all the way around, but now here she is with us on the phone today. So Therese Murray, welcome to the Experience 50 podcast.
Thanks, Mary. I'm so excited that you decided to let me be on the show.
Well, it's a delight. I loved working with you before, and it was kind of a mysterious little note that you sent my way, just saying that everything had changed in your life. So let's start with this. How old are you now?
I am going to be 54 next month.
Woohoo! Good for you. And so when we were last working with each other, you were in your mid-40s. So what happened?
Well, when I met with you last, I was on the work level. I was engaged in coaching, leadership coaching, helping executives who were either building their leadership skills or building their leadership teams, or they were in some form of a transition, maybe moving from one job to another or moving up the ranks. So I was involved in that line of work when we last met. I was also married at the time, and I was the stepmom of she would have been, I can't do the math. I'm going to say that she was probably around 11 at the time.
Mm-hmm.
So that's where I was when you and I met. And what I remember, in fact, looking at the pictures and reading my notes from back then, what the world saw was a very, very successful person who had a nice coaching practice working with people both in Michigan and across the United States. And somebody who was happily married and a mom and having the time of her life. That's what people saw.
Well, that's absolutely what I saw. I remember working with you and you were extremely professional and you were one of these, and it wasn't just a woman thing, but one of these people that your follow-up skills were so good. It always kept me up on my game.
Do you know, when you're talking to someone who's like, they give you deadlines and they want this, that, and the other thing, and they always do what they're supposed to do. And I was like, oh gosh, okay, I'm dealing with one of those people. And you were just so happy. So what wasn't I seeing?
Well, in looking back, and hindsight's 20/20, I was really good at what I did. I wasn't really, really good at who I was. In fact, I wasn't really even sure who I was. And about the time, actually, it was before I met you, with probably the 4 years previously, I had begun to feel this sort of unrest, this feeling like, you know what, I'm not really sure that I want the second half of my life to look like the first half has looked. And I was starting to, question different things at different levels. And one of the things that happened was I started to realize that I was having a lot of the same emotions and feelings that I used to have as a kid growing up within my marriage. And I thought, this is really unusual. Well, I pushed those things down for a long time because always my emotions and my state of mind was always second to my occupation and my success and my business stuff. I always pushed that other stuff away. And those things just kept getting bigger and bigger. And ultimately what happened was I realized that I needed to start taking care of myself in terms of recovery, meaning getting into a recovery program to figure out who I was and how who I was when I was a kid was impacting me as an adult. So that's kind of when things started to really change. And about the time I met you, things were really unraveling. They were really unraveling. And of course, you would have no idea. I was about 2 years away from bankruptcy. I was skidding financially. I was unable to focus on my business like I knew I needed to. I was completely consumed with what was going on around me in my house. And what was going on around me, I didn't even realize it, but it was really the family disease of alcoholism.
And are you an alcoholic?
I am. And you know, this is the funny part, though. I have to kind of back up. I got into recovery in a program for friends and families of alcoholics. And for the first year of that program, I was really focusing on the effects of the disease. Well, what happened was as I started to peel back the onion, I realized that I, too, am an alcoholic. And it was hard for me to believe because I was high-functioning. I was the responsible one. I was the one who paid the bills, right? I was the one who had the great job. I was the one who stood up in front of people and presented great ideas about how to live your life well. But I was, and if you know anything about what some of the quotes within the world of recovery, there's this term, I was restless, irritable, and discontented. It was a constant state that I always felt restless, I always felt irritable, I always felt discontented. And the only thing that would solve that feeling was for me to have a drink. And so I used alcohol my whole adult life, even during my childhood too, to really medicate the feelings that I didn't want to feel.
Now, so, were you a daily drinker or more of a binger?
Yes. you know what? I was a person who could stop. I could stop if I needed to. If the situation warranted me to stop, I'd stop. But once I started, I couldn't always guarantee that I was going to stop. But if I had a big meeting planned on Tuesday, I wouldn't necessarily drink on Monday because I wanted to be prepared. Again, my goal was to promote or to uphold the image that I had built of myself. So I couldn't let anything tarnish that image. So I was very, very careful in how I drank and with whom I drank. I needed to make sure that nobody would ever think that I was out of control.
Yeah, I had a guest on the show, I can't remember what episode it was, but a district court judge who was an alcoholic. And mm-hmm. He really, now that he has distance from it, he reflects on just being amazed at how hypocritical he was.
From well, you're living two lives, and that's what
exactly.
I was doing.
Yeah,
I was living two lives. I didn't even know it though. And see, that's the thing. You know, especially with the work I do with executives who are in recovery. That's the area that I'm working in right now. They don't even know. I mean, I didn't know what I didn't know, and my coach said it to me really well. He said, you know, fish don't know they're in water. I had no idea. You know, my whole life I lived around alcohol. I lived around alcoholics. I lived within alcoholism. I didn't know that I was affected by it. You know, they say the alcoholic is always the last one to know, and I know that to be true.
See, I still have a hard time wrapping my head around that because, for instance, I grew up with an alcoholic mother, and it was, for me, watching her as the model of what an alcoholic is, it was, you know, falling down the stairs and driving her car into places one shouldn't and, you know, just being fall down drunk. But I guess you don't need to be that way to still.
It wasn't my experience. And I got to tell you, when I first got into recovery for my alcoholism, it was really 6 months of me going to support meetings before I was able to identify with anybody because I was what they call a high bottom drunk. I didn't have consequences. I never was in trouble with the law. I never got a DUI. People didn't see me falling off of bar stools. They didn't see me falling down. They didn't see any of that. But I was able to identify finally about 6 months in when I heard a lady say, it was so funny, she said, you know, if I have 5 drinks, I'm good. But if I have that 6th drink, there's probably going to be some trouble or I'm going to do something stupid. And I thought to myself, I can believe that. And then I thought to myself, it's about the right math. And then another lady chimed in and she said, you know, I hear what you say about the 5 drinks. But she said, you know, non-alcoholics don't have 5 drinks in a sitting.
Right.
And my jaw dropped. And I thought, really? Because guess what? I only surrounded myself with people who drank like I did. I always had people around me who looked a little worse, so I never looked bad. So it took me a really long time to really identify that I could be an alcoholic without having all of those horrible consequences behind me. Now, again, hindsight 2020, I look back and I realize my alcoholism allowed me to accept a lot of unacceptable behavior because when things get really tough for me, I would drink. And so it sort of elongated the process of me disengaging from unhealthy relationships. I look at, you know, I had 2 failed marriages. I had a bankruptcy. I lost my house. That was alcohol related, not because I drank, but because I was affected by the disease of alcoholism in somebody else. And because my alcoholism allowed me to medicate to not worry, to not care.
Well, let's go back to talking about that restless feeling that you became aware of long before you became aware of the fact that you were truly an alcoholic. Because I think that is a pretty universal experience as we enter into midlife, is that things, you know, the ABC of who you have been is not necessarily the same formula after you hit, say, 45. So what process did you go through to really look at yourself where you came to the conclusion that you did? Not everybody is going to end up there, but how did you re-examine who you were?
Well, I was working with a coach, for one. I've worked with a coach since 2003, 2004, something like that. So I've been in a continuous process for the last decade of self-examination, which helped me come to a place of self-awareness. So that was if I had to name the one thing that was the most important, was being in a process of continuous improvement and a process of continuous awareness, deepening of awareness. you know, what are the other things that I did? You know, I look at my coaching process. It's very simple because we're complicated people, right? You know, we like to complicate everything.
Yeah.
So with my clients, again, they're executives, they're professional people, they're middle of their life people, they've had a lot of experience, so they're very complicated. So I distill the whole process of what to do. You said the ABCs. There's really four things that I have my clients take a look at, or there's four stages of working on themselves. The first one is awareness, figuring out, you know, you don't know what you don't know. And that takes form in a whole lot of different things. It could be assessments. It could be self-examination. It could be working with a therapist. It could be going to support meetings. It could be a whole lot of things. But awareness is the first piece in any improvement process. And then the second part is acceptance. And acceptance means owning it. What happens a lot of times is that's the painful part. You know, you become aware of something, and sometimes you can kind of dismiss it because it's painful. Acceptance doesn't let you dismiss it. Acceptance is where you do the work on realizing that it is what it is. You don't have to approve of it, but it is what it is. And then the third step is action, meaning playing out what are the different scenarios on how I could address this thing I've become aware of. I've accepted it is. Now I want to take action. You know, how am I going to do that? Training and that kind of development goes right from awareness to action. You know, you read the book, you start taking action, but you don't own it. And if you don't own it, it's not going to stick, right?
Right.
So the third part, like I said, is action. Everybody knows all about that. We're professional women. We know all about action. And then the last part is adherence, and that means staying in process. That means continually being in a process that you go to a deeper level of awareness and a deeper level of acceptance and more intelligent, effective actions. So that's staying in the process of improvement. And how do you do that? Recovery is a process of improvement. People don't go to recovery meetings and get cured. You know, they don't go to a treatment center and get cured. It's a lifetime commitment. Coaching is the same way. If I want to improve professionally, I'm not going to read a book. I'm not going to go to hear a speaker and get cured and, you know, see the light and praise the Lord and I'm good. If that worked, we'd all be skinny and rich. It doesn't work. We got to be in a process over time that helps us change. So that's what I do. Mm-hmm. You know, I use a coach. I'm ever becoming more aware of what's going on. I'm becoming more accepting of who I am, and I'm taking action on the parts that I don't like.
Congratulations.
Yeah. It's good work. It can be a little frustrating at a time because I'm a results-oriented person. I want it done now, right?
Right.
And it doesn't happen that way. Life has to unfold. You know, with my clients, I help them move forward, but they're going to move as fast as they can. I just give them the guidelines within which to move forward.
So, Therese, I want to ask you something. You had mentioned to me before we went on the air that you are an adult child of an alcoholic, correct?
Yep. Mm-hmm.
So,
yep.
And so am I. So I think growing up, that persona, well, is our persona. I mean, we are who we are into our genes. And
yeah,
even though you've stopped drinking, that really has nothing to do with the process of sort of healing yourself.
Yeah, without oversimplifying, the work that I've done through my recovery for alcoholism, my recovery as a family member to an alcoholic, and my recovery work I've done as an adult child, when I look at any issue in my life, any issue that has come up in a relationship, if I trace it back to its origin, it's adult child. You know, why is this? Because you're an adult child of an alcoholic. Now, I do not say that to blame at all. It's simply something that I know. I don't have to look for the why anymore in my life. The why, the answer to most of the why questions is because you grew up in an alcoholic home. So the real question is, so what? What are you going to do about it? And as an adult child, what we learn really, really well, and it's in our DNA, is don't talk, don't trust, and don't feel. And so I lived my whole life not talking about what the important stuff was, not trusting a slinging soul, and not allowing myself to feel. And alcohol was a really good way to not feel.
Right. Mm-hmm.
Right. I attract a lot of clients who are adult children. And that stuff, that adult child stuff, shows up in leadership like you wouldn't believe. And it shows up in things like this. Inability to state clearly what you need and express how you feel.
Yet, we're all overachieving, you know, kind of tap dancing across the room sorts.
Mm-hmm. Yep. And the not very well versed in setting boundaries, but B, upholding them, that over need to please. That comes up all the time for me. I will never not be an adult child of alcoholics,
right.
But I can, through that model that I share with you, be aware of when it's happening, accept that it is what it is, and take action based on that awareness and acceptance.
Mm-hmm.
But I have to stay in a process of becoming aware of that. Something that I've noticed in the women that I deal with, and again, the women who are attracted to coaches are usually pretty high-performing women, and they come to a coach for a whole bunch of different reasons. But what I've noticed is the women I have the opportunity to meet with who hold the title CEO, president, executive director, the top person at the organization, it's astounding the number of them who are adult children of alcoholics. How do I know? I ask. Because I can see in them the same traits that I possess. They can never do enough. They can never be enough. They can never prove enough. And they rise because they're so committed to the cause,
mm-hmm.
the cause outside themselves. And I'm not saying this to say that it's a negative. It's not. That's the positive end of the adult child thing. But the negative end is burnout, failed relationships, martyrdom.
Yeah.
that stuff we were talking about, that discontentment, that restlessness, that's the shadow side of that overachiever. So those are the people that I love to work with because, if they can actually start to become aware and accept that, what they went through as a kid infected them, but it affects them as a child, it affects them as an adult. They can make some choices today to act differently and
right.
have different outcomes and better relationships.
Well, so let's go back to the age factor of being in your middle-aged years, because I do think this just so many things present themselves to you, kind of, it's that look in the mirror reality check that happens along the way, that we start questioning who we are, or we start having enough brains to step back and look at our life and go, oh my goodness, I see some patterns here. And
oh, yeah.
I think for many, it is in fact that they grew up in a household with an addict. And do you find that people in, say, between 45 and 55 are shocked when they figure out that that's really what it is? I mean,
well,
you say you can see it in other people.
Yeah. But here's the thing. There's this very thick cloak of denial, which is a coping mechanism, right? That helps you get through denial. 9 times out of 10, when I start the conversation with a leader and we're talking about the work that I do, and I talk about working with recovering alcoholic and addict and codependent leaders, I'll say, have you ever been touched by alcoholism? 9 times out of 10, the answer is no. And I say, okay, so then we talk a little further, and by the end of that conversation, we've identified 2 or 3 people who are alcoholics in their immediate or extended family.
Really?
Yeah. And you know why? It's denial, but it's also stigma. There's a lot of shame.
Yeah.
And I can talk about myself on the shame piece. you and I would not be having this conversation 3 years ago about my recovery, because I was still not really sure if I wanted everybody in the world to know I was an alcoholic.
Mm-hmm.
Because what are you going to think? You know, what you're going to think about me is everything that you think about an alcoholic, and maybe that's not positive, and God forbid that you not think something positive about me.
Because that's the child in you, desperate for people to approve of you.
Absolutely. And, you know, I read in a book, the guy put it so well. He said, I'd become addicted to the image of myself I built. And I went, holy crap.
Wow.
That hit me between the eyes. I'm like, that's it. And, you know, in recovery, they talk about this idea of higher power, you know, a power greater than yourself. Well, you know, what was greater than myself was my image.
Mm-hmm.
And I worshiped my image. And I was a complete egomaniac with an inferiority complex.
Well, and that's a very common alcoholic combo.
Yeah, I had to build that. You know, I've got everything under control. And in essence, nothing was in control.
Right. Well, and let's talk about this. Doesn't have to present itself as alcoholism. As I said to Therese when we first started talking before we were recording, I said, you know, I'm an adult child of an alcoholic, and I have a whole list of addictions, but alcohol just isn't one of them.
Mm-hmm.
And so, I mean, you can, I'm assuming that if you grow up in that environment, you can become, I mean, I see shopping addicts, and just finished reading a book about a sex addict. And I mean, there are so many different ways that it can overtake your life and addiction.
Oh, sure. Yeah. In fact, I've heard it said, one of the experts said, if you're an adult child of an alcoholic, you're either going to become an alcoholic or you're going to marry one or both. And again, alcoholic can mean addict.
Yeah.
And I see a lot of people with, what addiction is it's a physical allergy, you know, so the people who have a substance allergy, alcoholics, addicts, you know, that, but it's also a mental obsession.
Mm-hmm.
So a mental obsession doesn't have to be substance oriented. It can be gambling, it can be shopping, it can be sex, it can be food, it can be, it could be all kinds of different things. The internet, it can be pornography, you name it. You know, we all have obsessions. And, you know, I think it was Gerald May who talked about, you know, we're all addicts in our own right. It's just a matter of managing them, managing our addictions, managing ourselves.
Yeah.
And, you know, becoming aware, going back to the old model, becoming aware, accepting it, and taking action. But I can't do that alone. I've got to have help from other people, and I have to have help from a power that's greater than myself. I can't do it on my own. Believe you me, for 47 years, I tried to do it on my own. It doesn't work. And one of the toughest things, besides admitting that I was an alcoholic, one of the toughest things for me to do was to accept help.
Mm-hmm. What was your turning point?
My rock bottom, when I finally said, I'm going to ask somebody to be my mentor, sponsors, what they call it in the recovery world, was when my then husband admitted to going on a cocaine binge. And I realized, holy God, this is ramped up to a whole new level, and I don't know what to do. I don't know what to do. I need help. And I went to a support group meeting, and I asked somebody for help.
And you thought you were getting help because you were married to someone who had that problem.
Yeah.
Not you.
But here's the thing, is that's the help that I needed. That was the presenting issue and the front burner issue. And I remember the person that I met, who is a very wise person, had been around, here's the irony, the person who I asked to help me was an addictions therapist. Now, do you think that the hand of God might have been involved in that one? Yeah. So this person had told me, you just need to sort your stuff out.
Yeah.
And I said, I don't even know what that means. And so this person helped me sort my things out. to the extent that as I learned about the disease of alcoholism and I learned about myself, I was left with, holy crap, I got this thing too.
Yeah.
But I couldn't have done that on my own. No way. No way could have done it on my own.
I'm so happy for you. I really am. I mean, you know, you think about it, you could have stayed on that same little treadmill for the rest of your life.
Yeah, I could have. But you know what? I believe strongly that I was placed on this earth to do some things that will help people out. And there was no way I could help people out in that. I mean, I was going to burn out. And I didn't think at 47 or 48 years old I was ready to die, and I knew that I couldn't live the way I was living.
Yeah.
So it had to happen. So it's been a journey. It's been a gas. I mean, believe me, my whole business of executive recovery coaching, that was not my plan.
Right.
I was quite happy working with normal executives.
Oxymoron again, but...
Right. And then I got tapped on the shoulder with this life experience that said, no, I think that you've got a story that needs to be told out in front of some business-type successful people, and maybe you'll attract some other people to a healthy way of life. So there you have it.
There you have it. And for people who... maybe are going into this midlife phase and feeling that internal turbulence, and you are an adult child of an addict. Teresa, can you give people some different scenarios of what things that might be happening to them that should be a light bulb going off? That maybe it is some of this adult child stuff going on?
Well, for me, it was the phrase that always came to my mind was, I have to fill in the blank. If it's got to be, it's up to me. If you're feeling really tired, if you're feeling resentful that you're just working harder than other people, if people just won't behave, they won't do what they say that they're going to do. These were the things that were popping up for me. If you're walking on eggshells around people, if you're afraid to address difficult topics because you're afraid of the reaction, those were some of the things that popped up for me, and those are some of the things that pop up for my clients that scream out, there's some old stuff here that needs to come out. And, you know, that people see therapists for this. I mean, therapists work through that a lot. A lot of times folks need to get therapy. I've used therapists. I still will use therapists if need be. But, in coaching, I just ask a lot of questions and bring things out to awareness. And when they become aware, then they can decide, okay, where do I need to get this kind of help? But it's that restlessness. It's that irritability. It's that general sense of discontentment and that nobody is cooperating. When you're pointing the fingers out, they say there's three times as many fingers pointing back at you.
Mm-hmm.
You're the common denominator in that. It might be an adult child thing. The other thing is people ought to, they can Google the adult child laundry list. It's called the ACOA laundry list. Boy, it's 13, I think, maybe 14. I can't remember exactly. It's a list of characteristics that are shared by adult children. It's pretty telling. Another thing, too, people sometimes are not adult children. They're adult grandchildren of alcoholics.
Oh.
They're raised by adult children. It's the same behaviors.
Mm-hmm.
It's the same thing. It's that same, walking on eggshells, that, not addressing things directly, taking care of things on the sidelines, all that stuff. That dysfunctional triangulation stuff. And you don't even have to have drinking around to have that happen.
Right.
Well, this has been terrific. I'm so glad that you are making this a part of your professional work now, because I know there are a lot of people out there who maybe they didn't even know it until they listened to this podcast.
I hope so, because there's hope for them. And, you know, we weren't placed on this earth to be unhappy.
Right.
We really weren't. So, you know, there's help available, and I'm just thrilled to be a resource to help people get to what they need.
Yeah, and your website is filled with resources and information on how they can get in touch with you. So why don't you go ahead and give your website address?
Okay, my website is www.meettherese.com, and that's spelled out www.meettherese.com. And if you go to my site, there's also links to Facebook, Twitter, and LinkedIn. I'd encourage people to link in there. I try to put some information out there that would be helpful to folks who are dealing with these kinds of issues.
Terrific. Thank you so much. And I'll include all of those links in the show notes that are attached to this episode as well. So, Therese, thank you so much.
You're welcome. And thank you, Mary.
Okay, guys, thanks so much for listening today. I really want to thank our guest, Therese Marie. And again, go to the website, experience50.com, and you'll see in the post, there will be links to the laundry list that she talked about. Also, we have a list of all of the telephone Al-Anon meetings that you can participate in. I thought this was fascinating information. I think that at midlife, a lot of us are just thinking, why am I so screwed up? Not all of us, but, you know, we're tweaking who we are. And I think that this is going to speak to a lot of you. So check out the website, again, experience50.com. And I want to thank our sponsor, Monthly Clubs. Again, perfect last-minute gift. I've used it. It really is so simple. You just go on and you create it, and then you can print out the certificate, put it in a nice little bag, and you have a gift, or they will email the recipient. So thank you again so much for tuning in to Experience 50. I love when I see that you have shared the podcast with your friends. It's just validation that what we're doing here is speaking to people, and I appreciate it so much. You can find us on Facebook and on Twitter, and we're just everywhere. So, love you guys. Have a great day.
The Experience 50 podcast is a Mary Rogers production.